This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Dale, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about water resources. In many parts of the world, demand for water currently exceeds available resources. And of course, we know that there are other places where presently the supply seems to be adequate, but that we know there is increasing pressure on that supply, both for individuals and agricultural use and industrial use. And certainly, as we know that as the population of the world continues to grow, the demand for water will grow. And we'll talk a little bit this morning about how we might meet this growing need. And our guest for the program is Mark Shannon. He's professor of mechanical engineering here at the University of Illinois. One thing particularly we'll be talking about is some of the research that is going on into technology that would make it possible to use water that now cannot be consumed by humans. And in fact, something like 99% of the water on the earth is not usable, either because it's salty or because it has some other kind of contaminant in there. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and questions certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, if you want to call in. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I also did not mention, and I should mention, that Mark is director of the Center of Advanced Materials for Purification of Water with Systems Center at the University of Illinois. We love long titles here at the University of Illinois. So right off the bat here, I think I should ask you to talk a little bit about what the center is all about.
Okay. Well, we call this the Water Campus. Even though it's C-A-M-P-W-S, that's the Welsh spelling for campus. So it's pronounced just like we would think, the Water Campus. And it's a National Science Foundation Center, Science and Technology Center, which is the largest type of center that the National Science Foundation awards. And as it turns out, we started writing this in year 2000, and I was just at the National Science Foundation where they said we were really leading the curve here. We were 5 years ahead of almost anybody else when they were starting to think about these issues. And it took several years to compete for it, and we began in basically in the year 2002, actually January of 2003, and we've been going for five strong years now, and we've got five more years of funding ahead of us. But our real goal and our whole purpose is really twofold. It's to develop revolutionary new materials and systems to purify water for human use. So we're not an environmental water center, although, of course, environment's very important. And we're not a center for ultra-pure water and other things, which, again, is important, semiconductor industry, pharmaceuticals. But we're really for human use, which really means domestic use, agricultural, energy use, the things that we use so much water for. Mm-hmm. And although we're focused on the United States because we're funded by the U.S. taxpayer, we are beginning a strong international program now as well because of the impact across the world. So we've been we're probably, in fact, I'm fairly sure of it, the largest such center in the United States and among the very largest in the world related to these issues. And we have some 50 faculty over 9 universities. So we're the central university, but we have MIT, Berkeley, Rose Holman, and our neighbors in Indiana, University of Michigan, Yale, Clark Atlanta University, which is a major university for us. So we have a number of different universities involved, 6 partners, which include national labs and the EPA, and some 12 companies that all belong to our center and our consortium here that really tries to come up with new materials, new systems. And then, of course, we have a large educational component because we have 120 students in our center spread out over all these universities. And we have very active programs for educating pre-college students, undergraduates, as well as graduate students. And so we have a major effort. We probably spend $1 million a year on education. So it's a huge, huge effort. And then we spend about $4 million a year on research. Mm. So it's among the very biggest.
Well, I want to just come back to a statistic that I looked at some material that you provided, and it really, I think, is very striking. And it might be surprising to people, and that's that number I dropped before. That is, I think it's more than 99%, slightly more than 99% of the water on the earth is not usable by humans. You couldn't take a glass of it, or you wouldn't want to take a glass of it and drink it. I suppose most of that is actually seawater, is ocean water,
sure,
which is salt water and can't be used. And then there are other places where there is some kind of contaminant in the water. And who knows, it could be an industrial chemical. It could be some naturally occurring bacteria that would make people sick if they drank the water. But the vast majority of the water on the Earth right now is not potable.
Yeah, exactly.
I was very struck by that.
Well, 97% of the water is tied up in the seas. And of course, you can't drink. I mean, we can use seawater, but we can't drink it directly. The remaining percent, almost 90% of that, is tied up actually in ice in Antarctica and up in Greenland. And then the remaining amount of water, it's about equally divided between saline water in aquifers under the ground and saline lakes. Which are, you know, have a different type of salt than seawater, which has its own special issues. And then there is much of the surface water on the Earth is mostly contaminated with pathogens, and it's an amazingly important problem worldwide. The statistics, you know, from when we started, they just keep getting worse and worse. Even with the Millennium Project through UNESCO and United Nations to try to, reduce in the number of people who don't have access to clean water down to zero, it continues to grow. 1.2 billion people on Earth don't have access to clean water. But really, probably even more important is that 2.6 billion people, a huge fraction, over a third of the people in the United States in the world, do not have access to basic sanitation. And in situations where you just don't have good access to sanitations, when there are floods, such as in India in the monsoons, it then contaminates all water supplies. And so the number of people who die in the developing worlds of bad water, 35% of the people in the world die from bad water or water-related problems. Mm-hmm. And that is hard for people in the West and industrial world to get their mind wrapped around. It's almost incomprehensible. A child dies every 20 seconds or less from bad water. And bad water is the number one cause of malnutrition in the world. You say, well, malnutrition, it is the leading cause of diarrheal diseases, which more people die from diarrheal diseases than any other, in fact, all other diseases and all other forms of death combined. So this is the biggest problem facing the world. And perhaps because of its just enormity, most people put it out of their mind. Mm-hmm. They don't want to think about it. So that's why most of the water isn't available. And we have to be able to, if we're going to make use of salt water, we have to be able to desalinate it. If we need to make use of other waters, we have to be able to decontaminate it. And then, of course, we have to disinfect water. And if we can do all those things, which we do very well in the United States, to an extent, and things are starting to change in the United States too, and so rapidly that's one of the reasons why I want to come on shows like this, to let people know that all is not sanguine in the United States either.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really, really important point, and something that I think it's good for people to think about when you talk about waterborne disease and problems with people having to depend on water supplies that aren't clean. Because if you really think about all the advances in technology that have benefited human health, if people think about antibiotics and modern medical technology and things like that, I think that it's fair to say, though, that really the most important advances that were made to improve human health were when we got to the point where it was possible for people to have access to clean water, and then we had sanitation systems so you could get their waste taken care of, and those two streams stayed separate. And it's something that we take for granted because you can go and just turn on the tap and you can have a glass of water. But that was not – it's not the case in a lot of other places around the world, and – it really wasn't the case in this country probably, well, at least until into the 20th century.
Absolutely.
That was routine here in the United States.
I actually have personal stories about that, and it really will surprise people. But the Romans gave us really, on a large scale, the water system and the sewer systems and have it separated by what's called an air break. The water from the supply system falls through the air. If you think about your tap, you turn it on and it falls through the air before it goes to the drainage system. And that was enormously powerful. And it really changed the industrial world in a real way. The other thing that was really the next major advancement took place thousands of years later with chlorine. And chlorine and chlorinating water has really been the major change in the United States for disinfecting our water. Much of the world, though, can't use chlorine because only industrialized nations that can generate chlorine and generate the chemicals we use to purify water, which is chlorine, ammonia, sodium hydroxide, which is lye, and muriatic acid or hydrochloric acid, which is really what's used. All these things are very industrial. They require lots of energy, big plants, big distribution systems. So the massive majority of the world cannot use any of those techniques to purify the water and disinfect because they simply don't have it. And they aren't going to get it in the foreseeable future. And so, you know, that's one of our roles is to come up with new ways to purify water that don't require those chemicals. The chemicals themselves, this process for disinfecting water and decontaminating with chemistry is itself adds problems to the water because all that water, when we come through our treatment plants and it goes back into the rivers, the stuff that comes back out, and it salts up our rivers, it further contaminates our rivers themselves, and it becomes an environmental problem and a significant one. So much so that all, if you think about the fresh, pristine water that falls as snow in the Rockies, and then it comes down, and we see all that beautiful water, and it gets picked up by communities, and then it gets put back in the rivers, and then it gets used for irrigation, and then you get the runoff, and all these chemicals congregate. So by the time it goes into Mexico, it's so salty it has to be desalinated. Yeah. And so the treatment itself is a problem in the way we currently do it. But in chlorination, my parents actually in the mid-50s in Biloxi, Mississippi, swam in a non-chlorinated pool, which they weren't chlorinating pools in the South, and both got polio, which was a waterborne disease. In fact, 250 people got polio in that pool. And so, you know, so it was, you would think, oh, in the 1950s, but so it was rather late, even in the United States, that chlorination became ubiquitous.
Yeah. So what we do generally, it sounds like here in the United States, in terms of water purification, essentially getting disease-causing organisms that would be in the water, it sounds like essentially what we're doing is we're using chemicals that kill those things.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Okay. So then we talked a little bit about this when you were visiting here before, and we were talking about nanotech research,
right.
That it sounds like what you're thinking about, we're looking at more kinds of filtration methods that essentially are mechanical filter.
One could say that. But when you get down to it's sort of, yeah, you physically separate. But we're also looking at things that use light, sunlight, in fact, with nanoparticles that as a pathogen or one of the disinfection byproducts, because that's the other problem that happens when you use these chemicals, they can combine and produce what we call disinfection byproducts that themselves are very toxic and highly carcinogenic. So this is one of the byproducts, and unfortunately, moving away from chlorine gas for security reasons, which many water treatment plants are trying to move away from that very rapidly, and they start to move to things called combined chlorine and solid forms of chlorine, they end up producing disinfection byproducts that can be very, very toxic and very carcinogenic. And so what do we do with those? So we need to decontaminate from that. So we're looking at using nanoparticles and sunlight that without any addition of chemistry can inactivate all the pathogens and also not produce disinfection byproducts and, in fact, destroy potent toxic chemicals that are in water to prevent it. Cancer-causing and other problems from these chemicals. So there are ways of using new technology to solve these problems and reduce our energy, reduce our use of chemicals, and get a healthier product to begin with at the end.
I have a couple of callers. We'll get to them in just a second here. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Mark Shannon. He's the J.W. Bain Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the U of I. He's also Director of the Center of Advanced Materials for Purification of Water with Systems Center. The Water Campus is what they call it here at the U of I. And among other things, they're particularly interested in looking at various kinds of technologies for purification of water, also removing the salt, desalination, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a couple here. Start with someone in Urbana, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. I was just going to ask you about something. You mentioned that every 20 seconds a child dies of have a gastrointestinal illness, diarrhea, and that's awful. And it seems to me, though, that if you were to address that kind of acute illness, that it'd be more effective to spend money on basic sanitation and disinfection technologies that have been around for hundreds of years rather than really sophisticated nanotechnology or UV treatment. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, that's an excellent point. The problems with water, and particularly in the developing world, such as in Africa, throughout the Mideast and Far East, these are, in many senses, political issues and how one can address this. Even issues of how you get the water and carry the water becomes very, very important. There's lots of issues with sanitation. So basic sanitation is the key issue for much of that world. And you can, by improving basic hygiene and basic sanitation, you can go a long ways towards that. Our center that I was talking about, so we may have confused the issues just slightly, is that we're focused on developing new technologies and materials for primarily the United States because we're a U.S.-funded center. However, some of these same techniques that we're developing here are finding applications. In fact, we have a program in Africa, two programs in Africa, where we're using the materials that have been developed in our center for potable water, such as by putting lining vases that you pour water into with antimicrobial materials such as silver and some of these other materials that we're talking about that are actually ended up being very low cost. And as the water's being carried, it's disinfecting. One of the biggest problems is actually hands going into the vases and coming back out. And by pouring it, we actually can disinfect. A group in Switzerland showed that by using just the types of bottles we use with 2-liter bottles and laying it out into the sun actually proves to be a very potent pathogen. But much of what we have to do is related to education, providing pit toilets. In fact, I with a group of people, the Water Advocates Group, that are trying to build 1 billion pit toilets in the world. So a lot of this can have a large impact. And so you're right. It doesn't mean that nanotechnology is going to be the solution for the developing world. And I didn't mean to imply that. But there are places that, in fact, there is crossover. What I was trying to say is that our current way of dealing with it, by building big chlorine plants and chemical plants, is not going to be suitable for much of the world. And so we have to start thinking in different ways of doing this. And building low-cost filters is one of those ways. We're even developing methods for desalinating water in a very low-cost way because much of the world that has these problems has really water supply problems that are quite extreme that forces people to use water they know is, in fact, contaminated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Here's someone else, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, appropriate technology is a good phrase, it seems to me, something appropriate to the circumstance. But I wanted to, the fact that you're emphasizing chlorine and then saying, you know, what your center is doing, my understanding is Urbana, the Northern Illinois water, uses mostly peroxide to sanitize the water or sterilize it or whatever its appropriate expression, as opposed to chlorine, and that they do chlorine case by case depending on readings that are done in various mains and that sort of thing. So the chlorine should only be used in exceptional circumstance when they've had bad pressure. Northern European cities and areas, I think, use ozone, oxygen bleach to sanitize. So they can use, that may be energy intensive, I guess, if you're generating the ozone and then bubbling it through the water or and a combination of UV. But that's already available. I mean, of course, it'd be great if it could be done in a cheaper way rather than using energy to create the ozone on site. But so there are already other alternatives in interim, it seems like. So I just, you know, I was moved to call when you were talking about this industrial system we have for sanitizing water in most places in the world. That are using sanitization systems at all. And then the chlorine obviously is to be phased out. Thanks.
Okay. Well, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I selected chlorine just because it's still the dominant form. And certainly ozone and other forms of oxidants are used to disinfect water in the industrial world. chlorine still dominates, and combined chlorine is where most things are moving. So even if they're moving away from chlorine, they're still not eliminating chlorine. And even in systems that use ozone and peroxides, they still use chlorine, you know, like monochloramine, things like that, as residuals. But the overall picture, there's also issues and problems with ozone, with peroxides, and the various things that are used as well, permanganates. So that leave the same sort of problems, and one needs to, and one of the things we are looking very closely at for this country and industrial world is well, what can we do to reduce and use different methods, hybrid methods between solar, UV, ozone, and various chlorine products to minimize the impact and maximize the disinfection and inactivation. In terms of water purification, disinfection has always been the first and foremost thing that people think about. But what has been happening over the years, in particular, is that, you know, that is a problem that dominates the surface waters. But as what's been happening over the years is that we've been moving farther and farther away from surface water and been using more and more water out of aquifers, freshwater aquifers, deep aquifers. And these have their own sets of problems in terms of contaminants. And for the most part, what we use, and other countries, and particularly in Europe, is they've been using dilution as the solution. So you find some clean water, you dilute until you get, you know, adequately clean water. So, but as water and these aquifers get more and more contaminated from industrial processes, as well as agriculture, as well as just plain human activities, digging through soil and breaking through and getting this cross-contamination, we've been finding that more and more water needs to be treated, and it becomes more, and primarily it's because of a decontamination issue with various things from arsenic, which we have locally, and we've been diluting. But if our aquifers start to be depleted, what are we going to do about that? And in the big, one of the biggest health problems in the world is the arsenic that comes from groundwater that we, the UN and the world communities, put through in the Bengal region, Bangladesh and East India, where there are 30 million people suffering from arsenic poisoning now because of groundwater contamination. So groundwater is becoming a much, much bigger issue. And I always say to people, I say, when it comes to water, it's the aquifer, stupid. You've got to just think about the aquifers and what we're doing to the aquifers and what we're doing to deplete, you know, basically fossil water that much of the Great Lake regions do, and we're depleting many parts of that very, very rapidly.
I mentioned we're talking about the issue of, we've touched on a little bit of on the issue of desalination, removing the salt, and that's certainly the kind of thing you think about with ocean water. If you're thinking about using that as a water source, obviously that's going to be an issue. A lot of people do get their water from the ground. Here, for example, we draw on the Mahomet Aquifer, and I think probably a lot of people think of aquifers as being fresh water. Apparently, there is available water in the ground that's got salt in it. So that one of the things that you're looking at, or I'm sure that somebody is looking at, is the issue of desalination of groundwater. And you also said a little bit earlier that the kind of salt that's in there is different from the kind of salt that's in the ocean, so it's a slightly different kind of a problem. Is there, for example, if we just talk about the United States, is there a significant resource of groundwater that's potential to be used but has got salt in it so that it would have to be desalinated before we could use it? I mean, is there a significant
Absolutely.
Amount of water there available?
Actually, I have maps that can show you that we have more saline aquifer in the United States than we have freshwater aquifers. It's a larger quantity of water. We already have pumps. Typically, the deeper you go, the more salty the water gets. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we have huge numbers of pumps. They're pumping this water all the time. And we call those oil wells, oil and gas wells. And they, for every, you know, barrel of oil you pump, you typically pump 2 to 350 barrels of water. And it's typically these saline waters. And so they're separated, and then the water is too salty, and typically it's either re-injected or it's concentrated in or deposited depending upon its salinity and what's in the water. But these waters, typically salt water in the sea is mostly sodium chloride, which, you know, we think of as table salt. Yeah. But the water that's in, the saline water that's in these aquifers is much less chlorine atoms, chlorine ions, and sodium. It's more calcium, calcium phosphate, calcium sulfates, magnesias, and these what we think of as hard water. So when you think about the types of salt that in this water is, you know, if you've been in a place that has hard water, well, that's salty, you know, that's salty water, and it's the white stuff and the limey stuff. And this is much harder to separate than the sodium chloride. It fouls up membranes and fouls things up. The other thing that comes along with this is that what do you do with the rejectate, the stuff that's left over, the brine, the concentrate? Well, that is one of the key problems. And if you deposit it in the Southwest, which, you know, you can use the sun, a lot of times they just put it out on the land and let it evaporate. But that becomes an environmental problem because you're also concentrating all the other stuff and all the poisons and toxins, and it becomes a toxic sludge at that point. And if you're up here, we can't do that because, of course, it rains all the time and it's not going to evaporate and it'll spread everywhere. So what do you do with it? And that's a really key problem that we've been working on, because if we could do this, it could open up large amounts of water available across every continent, actually.
Well, what would just – and I promise I have people here I'll get to. What at the present technology, what would it cost – for that water, if we decided, well, we really wanted to draw on the saline aquifers, what would it cost to make that water usable, and how would that compare to what is the average cost of water now?
Well, it depends on really every local water is different. So every source water is different. So it's really hard to get a good measure of that. But if we were to say take moderately salty water, which would be, say, 10,000 to 15,000 parts per million of salt in water, and seawater is about 35,000, just, you know, so half the saltiness of seawater. It probably costs between $800 to $1,000 an acre foot to take care of the brine and everything. An acre foot is a foot of water spread out over an acre. That's 325,000 gallons of water. Okay. And that would be compared to what our pumping costs are here, it would be about eight times more expensive than the water we're using currently, which just would put it way out of the realm of most people. And the key problem facing the United States is that our population is growing so fast, and our use of water per person is not decreasing faster than the population is going up. So we're going to have to start drawing on these non-traditional water sources. And so we're going to be blending water that started off at, say, $50 to $100 to $150 an acre foot and transferring it to $5 to $1,000 an acre foot, which will cost most people's water bills to just soar. And it's already happening in many places in the United States. It's one of this creeping cancer that's slowly but surely hitting various places. And as long as it's somebody else and we're not thinking about it. But just think of what happens if our aquifer goes dry. What would suddenly happen to our water bills?
Yeah.
They would just go through the roof. We wouldn't be able to touch it.
Well, just very quickly then, if you were thinking about using that kind of water, and as you explained, the problem is that it has minerals in it. It may have other, you know, who knows, may have heavy metals in it. It may have all kinds of things that you'd have to get out there that are naturally occurring. They're just in there. Then what do you, once you separate those things out, what do you do with them? Are there potential industrial uses, or is it something you just have to store someplace?
Well, if you can really concentrate it, it actually has some industrial value. I mean, these salts, you could probably $50 a ton. But if it costs you $500 a ton to get it, then it doesn't make much sense economically. But if you just left it in this form that's not very concentrated, then it becomes toxic waste, and you have to do something and spend a lot of money for it. So that's the other thing that prevents its real use.
Well, we have several callers here. We're a little bit past our midpoint talking with Mark Shannon. He's professor of mechanical engineering here at the U of I and is also director of the Center of Advanced Materials for Purification of Water with Systems Center. And it's a center here, and they also have people at other universities at different places around the country where they're looking at technologies for water purification. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let us talk next with someone in Decatur, line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. I was hoping to hear an overview of the current and present technologies of desalination. If you could comment on or compare thermal versus reverse osmosis, and what are the prospects of commercially viable technologies that we might see in the future for providing, you know, for desalinating water, especially as it pertains to seawater.
Okay, that's a great question. Currently, more than 50% of the water in the world is done by thermal evaporation. They're called multi-stage, where you pull a slight vacuum on it, you boil it, and you pull the water off, and then condense it, and you sort of like a still. You think about how you boil water and boil still and take the condensate off. Mm-hmm. That's pretty expensive because it's really energy intensive. But even in places like in Saudi Arabia, where they're still flaring off natural gas, energy's free essentially to them. It's still very expensive because you've got to build these big stills and big stainless steel, and they scale up. There's lots of scaling and fouling that occurs, and you have to clean it, and they're very, very expensive. So that water is still expensive, and it costs typically between $1,200 and $1,500 an acre foot to do it that way. So it's pretty darn expensive. Then the thing that's really picked up and taken off is what's called reverse osmosis, where you take a membrane and you put a pressure across the membrane, and that membrane can pass water, but it can't pass salt. So you pressurize it so it pushes the water across, leaving the salt behind. These units are being developed worldwide, and Singapore and Israel are two examples where we've been looking very closely, where the entire nation is going to complete desalination. Israel is doing this because they say it's cheaper to desalinate 100 million cubic meters of water, which I can't tell you how much that is, but it's a lot of water, per year, than it is to go to war with Syria for one day. And that's why the Knesset decided their entire country is going to go to desalinated water from the Mediterranean using reverse osmosis. They've built hundreds of millions of cubic meters of plants to do this. And they pay for their energy. And they're coming down to about $720 to $750. They think they may get it as low as $680 an acre foot of water. Singapore is blending their water, and they're actually taking a part of their one of their harbors and building a dam and basically desalinating all their water. They're being really pushed by Malaysia cutting off their water. And then the one that should surprise everybody, and why I went there this summer to really find this out, is Switzerland. They have the Alps. They have pristine water. They don't even chlorinate their water. They've got so much water. Why? They have developed an entire national lab to come up with new ways to purify water. And you're saying, why? Why would Switzerland do this? Because 60% of their energy comes from hydroelectric power, 40% from nuclear, and the glaciers that feed their water are expected to go dry by 2020 to 2030, and their water will become intermittent. And they're scared to death. So they're trying to figure out how they can take their water that they've already used and reuse it, which is really the biggest source of water, which I haven't really talked about, that we could do, is direct reuse of water. Singapore is already doing it. So there's, we can get water so clean. In fact, we're already reusing water. If you're in St. Louis, you're reusing the water from the folks in Minneapolis and anywhere along any major river system. But people don't like to think about the fact that it's being reused water. But there's lots of good technologies. We're working on new technologies that could dramatically drop that cost from, say, $680 down to $400, maybe even $300 an acre foot.
So in those places where they're really heavily into desalination, like Israel or Saudi Arabia, what do they do with the salt that's left over?
Well, in the sea, if you're doing seawater, it's okay because you just deposit it back into the sea. To a point, if it gets too concentrated, it actually becomes an environmental problem. So they actually have to build a distribution system because it can't. You'll affect the sea life. But if you're inland, that's the problem. If you have access to a sea, you can wash it. So basically, you're just making the seawater more concentrated. But it's such a big sea that it's not going to really matter. But in inland, it's a big problem. And there are places in Israel that they do desalination more inland, and then they pipe it, and they are building big pipelines to pipe the drainage to the sea. And that's really expensive.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk next with someone else. This is someone in Urbana, and I believe that would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. I have kind of two questions. The one is, I wonder if Dr. Shannon would kind of give a prognosis for 25 years out. I've heard that, that water is going to be the next source of great civil conflict. And so and I've heard some stuff from water camps about, in the next 25 years or so, what it's going to look like in the United States, much less the rest of the world. So maybe a sort of prognosis on that. But my larger question actually is, we have a history as human beings of using resources in our natural environment and not thinking about what the potential consequences are going to be, thinking that things are constantly renewable. And your point actually about the desalination of ocean water kind of brings that to mind to me too, that, you know, it's true that the oceans are very large, and so to a certain extent, you know, if we mess with them, it will settle out. But I'm thinking also of things like making wide-scale use of things like the saline aquifers that we've not done before. And what is there much going on in terms of trying to figure out what the consequences of using resources that we haven't used before will be for just even just the availability of water in the future and that kind of thing. So I'll hang up and listen to the responses. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the questions.
Those are excellent points. And I can't emphasize how many talks I've given around the country, now world, about thinking about the overall impact of the sustainability of what we're doing with respect to water and energy and agriculture and in the environment. Many of the, you know, it's the unintended consequences, you know, that the listener was referring to, that you have to try to think about what you're doing. Now, the interesting thing about the saline aquifers that we're doing, there's huge amounts of water already being pumped out of these. And you know, there's impact right now as to what you're doing with this water currently, and this is happening all over. So the question is could we utilize that water? Is this water currently a environmental problem? In many places, it in fact is an environmental problem, and not the United States that I'm aware of, but in other parts of the country, world, they just take it and they dump it out onto the land, and it's, you know, without any further treatment after you've separated out some of the oil and gas. So these environmental impacts are huge, and the sustainability of what we're talking about is a major issue. If we just simply, you know, take one water source, and one of the main things that, as a key example of are we thinking ahead, is taking water out of an aquifer to generate, say, ethanol. If you just do a once-through system without thinking about the economics, the cheapest thing you can possibly do, you need fairly clean water to make ethanol. So you pull out the water, and it takes about 130 gallons for cooling and the evaporation, et cetera, for every gallon of ethanol you get back. Just take it once through and dump it out. And if you take it out of an aquifer and dump it out, you're just, and particularly an alluvial aquifer, an aquifer that's fossil water, you could be depleting that aquifer without ever really thinking about, is it sustainable? The changes happen so fast. In the state of Minnesota, 20% of all the aquifer draw now that's occurred over the last 10 years is now for producing ethanol. Now, if you go to what's called zero discharge and you spend extra capital and money, you can recycle that water and you can bring it down to 4 or 5 gallons for every gallon, which is much more sustainable. Mm-hmm. And if you spend even more money, you could get it almost to 1 for 1. So there is an issue of money, and there's a large number of groups from ADM and Cargill and whatnot that are really pushing for the zero discharge. But it costs more. And so, you know, there's always trade-offs in every technology that one thinks about. There's going to be a trade-off. Now, with respect to the seas, the amount of salt that we're talking about versus the size of the sea, it won't impact the seas overall, but it could impact local areas. If you just deposit it, it might impact a reef. And if you think about this happening again and again and again throughout the world, which we're already impacting the seas, it could have a major effect. So one is absolutely right. You have to think very carefully about what you're doing so that you don't have an irrecoverable environmental damage. And so this is one of the most important topics, I think, that we should engage in as a people, is what are we doing, how are we doing it, and what's the long term, and can we sustain it? We just have to ask that question, can we sustain it?
Yeah. Well, certainly it's efficiency of use, no matter what the use is, has got to be really important here. And I'm sure that by being more efficient and conserving water, we could reduce the amount, significantly reduce the amount of water that we do use and put less pressure on
the
resource. But there again, that I suppose that also amounts to spending money because we'd all need to go out and buy new toilets and buy low flow shower heads and think more carefully about when we turn the tap on, do we just stand there and let it go? And then you have to think about some, you know, industrial uses and also agriculture, which is the biggest user of water by far.
Right. But then again, if you think, well, we'll just cut that, well, then we talk about increasing our food costs too. So it's one of these things that, you know, the impact is large. I think we need to start thinking, well, what is our water footprint? We're now starting to get used to the idea of what's our carbon footprint, but what's our water footprint? What impact are we having? For instance, if you fill up a tank of gas, you know, you might put in 20 gallons of gas. Well, you've essentially put in 250 to 260 gallons of water right along with it. You just don't even see that it took that much water to get you that much gas. And so, and you know, a pound of beef, well, you know, 15,000 liters of water went into that. So you start to think about how much water goes into each and every aspect of what we consume. It would actually shock people as to how much water they use.
Yeah. Okay. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Mark Shannon. He's professor of mechanical engineering here at U of I. And we have several other questions, so we'll try to get in everyone. Next is Crete. Someone listening in Crete and line 3. Hello.
Yeah, great program. Thanks, Mark, and thanks for the program. Mm-hmm. I have a question. Just is there about 15 years ago, I read in the Popular Science magazine that a research scientist was taking moisture out of the air and using it for drinking water. Is that anything you've ever heard of?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's being done there. But when one talks about the grand total of amount of water, the amount of water that's in air is less than 1/1,000th of a percent of the water. So, yes, there is water in the air, and you can supply water in the air. In fact, we get our rain from water in the air, and you can condense it out in arid climates even. However, in terms of the grand totals, compared to aquifers and compared to rivers and lakes, it's just a tiny, tiny amount. But clearly, you can do it. There's some expense involved. We're going to even have a project with our students, our graduate students and undergraduates, to build what looks like a Ferris wheel, where we'll take it and it will dip into the sea and be run by power, and then it will let air blow over it, and then we'll condense the water out to make a energy-free way of desalinating water. It'll work really well in low appropriate technologies, low technology areas, but you won't get a lot of water out of it. But you can get enough at a fairly low cost that it can provide a small number of people with water.
Okay. Well, let's talk next with someone in Urbana, and this would be line 1. Hello.
Hello. I get the impression that we do not know the exact dimensions of the Mahomet Aquifer, yet we certainly seem to be moving toward a number of Dassel Hall plants. Would you comment on that, and would you comment on Las Vegas? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, this is the issue around the world, and not just us. I actually, when I give this talk around the world, I say even in our own little local community, we just don't have enough information about aquifers, period. It's the aquifer, stupid. We need to know how much water is going in, how much water is coming out, how they flow. Because the other thing that most people don't realize is they're actually interconnected. Aquifers, you know, are connected. These sand aquifers are interconnected with each other. And how much flows in and out, there's just not enough data. And it's very difficult to get that data. And there's no one group that collects data, unlike surface water, which is, you know, the USGS, the Bureau of Reclamation, the EPA looks at surface water. Groundwater is a case-by-case, community-by-community, area-by-area in the United States and much of the world, actually. And so how much water is in there is an absolutely excellent question. I know that there has been money put in the budget several times in the past to really do a thorough analysis, and then for budgetary reasons and other perhaps political reasons, the money was cut out. But the money's back in, from what I understand, and they're doing the water survey, and others are starting to look at this very closely. But it's actually much harder than it seems. It's not just to, you know, drill down and know how much. You have to really do a lot of study. And it's the other thing that I've been going and arguing in Washington a lot about. We must spend more money, our taxpayers' money, to find out this case. I like to say, you know, it's so important that if we don't address this in a timely fashion, it is going to cost every man, woman, and child that's alive in America today tens of thousands of dollars if we don't address it quickly. So I'm saying we should spend $1 billion to save $1 trillion.
All right. Well, it's probably sometime soon what we should do is call our friends over at the Illinois State Water Survey and have Derek Wynn Stanley come back over here. And past couple of summers, he's come by in the summertime, and we have just had a kind of a general conversation about water, where it comes from and the water that we use, and probably it would be good for us to do something just focused really on, you know, local issues in that respect, because certainly there are a lot of people who are thinking
about it. Yeah, they're much more qualified than I to talk about water resources in Illinois, right. Of course, because we work on technology. They work on water resources.
Let's talk with someone in Chicago. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
What is the condition of the water that goes through our sanitary plants in Stickney after it's processed?
Well, you know, Chicago, I actually use Chicago as an example. Chicago as a whole is a fantastic example because Chicago as a whole has four plants that produce as wastewater. It's 200 cubic meters a second, which
wow.
200 cubic meters a second of wastewater. I mean, basically fills up the Chicago River is the outflow. Mm-hmm. The Chicago River, of which, you know, originally flowed to Lake Michigan, but, you know, then they actually changed the course of the river. So because of pollution problems going into Lake Michigan and the draw of the water out of Lake Michigan, Chicago does not meter its water, the Chicago citizens, nor do they see it, you know, overtly. And so the Chicago citizens themselves are very, very water rich. But all the outlying areas is one of the most critically impacted areas in the country because of the drawdowns of the aquifers. So that water resource, it's only secondary treated. They're looking at going to tertiary treatment. And if it was tertiary treatment, it's nearly of potable quality. It's currently not potable quality, obviously. And we're actually doing experiments and work with the Chicago Municipal District to see, can we take some technology so we can bring it all the way up to potable water? Then it's actually, it's one of the largest sources of water that we could come up with. I mean, it's all will be very high quality. But currently it's not at that level.
Oh, potable water, is that safe water?
Yeah. That's water you can drink.
I heard a remark that Detroit dumps 28 billion gallons of sewage in the lake every year. Is that so?
It could very well be so. I don't know what the value is for Detroit itself.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. That we're getting down to the point here. We just have a couple of minutes left. I do think it's really interesting. I know people maybe will be uncomfortable with the idea, but the fact that here is a resource, the water that goes down our drains and that we flush down our toilets – As waste, obviously that's problematic, but that's also a usable resource that theoretically could be cleaned up, and then you could get that to the point where people could drink it. They might not want to know that's that's what they were drinking, but you know it seems a shame to waste that if it could somehow be cleaned up and
yeah, well
again.
Actually, this reused water, you can get to the quality that's better than the quality that people pull in from the rivers. Seriously, I mean, you can get it so clean, and you can remove, and you can, in fact, the whole cleaning up process, if we do it in intelligent ways using membrane bioreactors that we're working on, you can actually get a source of energy from that, and you can get nutrients, and you can actually get mm-hmm. valuable product out of the cleanup.
So what does that do to your cost of the water?
It goes up, and it goes up considerably. So mm-hmm. so if what we're shooting for is if you could get that product water out, it would be a lot, around $400 an acre foot, half of that of desalination. So it's still, if you think about it that way, it's a bargain.
Yeah. And I suppose if you then fold that back into your total water base, that's still something that you wouldn't want to waste.
And when we look at the fact that with the current growth of population in the United States, we will need to increase our water supply, even if we go to a draconian conservation scheme where everybody domestically uses 60% less water than they're using today. Agriculture uses 20% less. Industry uses 30% less. We cut our energy use per person by 30% because energy is a huge consumer. Even then, we need to grow our water supply by 30% in this country because of population growth. If we continue to use the same amount we use today, we have to grow it by 40%. If we use the amount that we are currently increasing our use, because our uses are increasing, we have to grow it by 60%. There isn't that water out there. It's just not there. We don't have it. So to grow the water that type of amounts. And so we have to start looking for new sources.
Yeah. So even you're saying that water's not, even if we were cleaning up available, say if we tapped our saline aquifers and we used the water that we're pumping out of the ground as a part of oil production and all that, even if we were able to use that and maybe other surface waters that are now not usable, even if we brought all that in, that still would be not enough?
Well, if we'd start doing that, yes, it would be enough. But if we continue to use just the
current available
supplies, we don't have enough to grow it.
Yeah. All right. Real quick, maybe we'll try here one more caller. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yeah. What was this? There was a license in terms of BP, in terms of the byproduct into Lake Michigan. And what happens is that they were able to, you know, they're going to add on to another refinery. What would be the byproduct that would go into? Do you know that case or not?
No, I'm afraid I'm not aware of that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Right.
All right. Well, we're at the point here. I think pretty much we're going to have to finish up. My apologies. We have a couple of callers that we can't take. Any last sort of idea or thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, I just want everybody to start thinking about. You know, we've taken water for granted. We don't really understand the value of water as a people. Water is absolutely ubiquitous in everything. Our economic well-being, our health, our environment, everything depends on water. How much our cost of energy? I mean, we talk about growing energy and our growing energy needs, but unless you have water, water is an enormous part of the generation of energy. We can't get cheap water without cheap energy. We can't get cheap energy without cheap water. Same thing with our agriculture. If we start thinking about the impact of water and we on our food costs, they could go through the roof. Everything of what we do in every aspect of our life depends on it. And we've taken it for granted because we've been traditionally the most water-rich country on earth. Canada slightly exceeds us, but not by a lot. And things are changing, and things are changing rapidly. And already in various parts of the country, people are waking up to the fact that, you know, they're out of water. And in the year 2000, 50% of the people in the United States paid $20 a month or less. In just 20 years, we're going to be spending many, many times more than this. And so our average standard of living will change unless we can think about new ways of addressing water.
Our guest this morning, Mark Shannon, he's professor of mechanical engineering, director of the Center of Advanced Materials for Purification of Water with Systems Center here at the U of I. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.